When we think about practicing the way of Jesus, we're setting off on a course of life. We're aiming for a particular destination, to be like Jesus, to be with him, to do as he did. And Comer points out at the start of this that whenever we're setting goals or going on a trip, we need to have a compelling vision of where we want to arrive, and we need a plan for arriving at the destination. So Kate and I are trying to make our Thanksgiving plans. We know we want to go to Atlanta. We have a vision of where we want to be and what we want to do there, but now we have to come up with a plan for how to get there. And we have to factor in our dog. We have to factor in the fact that it's, I mean, Mary Jo, if you want our dog over Thanksgiving, you let me know. But, you know, we have to factor in, like, the fact that it's 16 hours away. So we need both the compelling vision and the plan to get there. Otherwise, our good intentions won't get us there. And I think that's true for all of life. So Comer laments, most people have a plan for their money, a budget, a plan for their time, a schedule, and all sorts of plans for their education, career, retirement, family, kids' soccer team, gym routine, and so on. But very few have a plan to be with Jesus and thoughtfully apprentice under him in such a way that over time, they become the people who naturally do and say the kinds of things Jesus said and did. So Christians need a thoughtful, conscious, intentional plan for our spiritual lives. Or in other words, we need to intentionally design our lives to give Jesus free reign over our formation. So growth as a Christian disciple requires that we plan for growth as a Christian disciple. It requires us to rearrange our lives around following Jesus. So Comer writes, we must rearrange our days, our morning routines, our daily habits, our schedules and budgets and relationships, the entire webs of our lives, so that we are deeply enjoying every day with God. This will require most of us not only to arrange our days, but also to rearrange our days from the hurry, digital addiction, and chronic exhaustion that we've been conditioned to believe is normal when, in reality, it's truly insane. So we have to, I think the point is clear. We have to have a plan for following Jesus, or else our good intentions aren't going to get us there. Intentional planning is necessary, and Christians throughout the centuries have intentionally planned to follow Jesus through something called a rule of life. Are you, any of you familiar with that term, a rule of life? Yeah, Ben is, okay. So a rule of life, what does this sound like? It kind of sounds like rules for living, which is kind of it, but it's not so much individual rules for life, but it's a way of going about life that supports the vision that we have for our lives. So this is popular even in non-Christian literature. So if you've heard of Jordan Peterson, he has a book called 12 Rules for Life. And it's just this psychologist who comes up with 12 rules, or you could substitute the word principles for life. You know, I think one is like stand tall with your shoulders straight or something. You know, I forget all of them. But there are principles or maxims or ways that we organize our life with. That's all that this is talking about. So a rule of life is like a trellis that supports a vine. So it's a support structure that enables healthy growth and supports the weight of the fruit produced by the vine. So the rule of life is essentially a structure, a support structure for spiritual growth. But what exactly is the rule of life, as Comer's talking about it? He defines it as a schedule and set of practices and relational rhythms that create space for us to be with Jesus, become like him, and do as he did as we live in alignment with our deepest desires. So it's a way of intentionally organizing our lives around what matters most, which hopefully for all of us is God. In other words, it's putting God at the center of our life and then strategically planning to keep God at the center of our life. It's an intentional plan for following Jesus. Basically, this whole lesson and this whole section of the book is intended to convince people that you need an intentional plan for following Jesus. So it may get a little bit repetitive here, but I think it's worth reflecting on this. We need to commit to Jesus in a way that produces a structure that helps us follow in the right direction. Now, for a lot of people, a rule of life might seem artificial or, you know, not very genuine, the opposite of a genuine relationship with Jesus. But it's worth considering that in every area of life that's important to us, we put in a structure that's not truly, like, just a free, authentic expression of ourselves, just doing whatever we want in the moment. Instead, the things that we love the most deeply and the things we care about the most, we implement a structure that actually reins us in from doing whatever we'd want to do. And by reining us in, it allows us to do what we actually really want to do. So if you really want to go to Cancun on a vacation, you're going to implement a structure that keeps you from the lesser desires of that pair of shoes or that Happy Meal at McDonald's. I don't know if nobody's here is eating a Happy Meal at McDonald's, but you know what I'm saying. Okay, maybe Dale, it seems like. It reins in our lesser desires, our desires to accumulate other things, so that we can pursue our deeper desire, which is going to Cancun. I mean, this is the same thing with marriage. We take vows to structure our love in a particular direction. So as I was preparing to officiate Ruth and Vlad's ceremony on Sunday, I was recalling this letter. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a letter, a wedding homily for his sister, because he was imprisoned by the Nazis, so he couldn't go officiate the wedding. And in this wedding sermon, this wedding homily, he says something like, your love has led you to this marriage, but from this day forward, your marriage will uphold your love. So it's not just the flight of our desires and, you know, what we feel that is really what needs to keep us in commitment. We structure ourselves so that we remain committed. A rule of life basically does that. He writes, in both marriage and life with God, it's the constraint of commitment that will create space for love to mature and real transformation to occur. And whether you realize that or not, we all have a rule of life. We all have a way of life. We have habits, routines, budgets, things we spend our free time on, and so on. So the question isn't really, do you have a rule of life? It's, do you know what your rule of life is? How are you already structuring your life, consciously or unconsciously? So several people, you know, whenever a book is published, people are going to critique that book. And I just read an article this week that's titled, "You Don't Need a Rule of Life," kind of pushing back against this a little bit. And I wonder if they read carefully this section in Comer's book, where we all already have a rule of life. We have a way that we're living, so we need to be thoughtful and conscious about it. We need to intentionally structure our life so that we do what I think our heart's deepest desire really is. It's to be with Jesus, to follow after him, to become like him. And later, Comer will talk about pursuing your heart's desire. I think that's what he's talking about. In the way that C.S. Lewis or Augustine or Jonathan Edwards talks about, beneath all our lesser desires is a desire for God, but we stop short of our deepest desire. So Lewis uses this analogy of a child playing in a mud puddle because he doesn't know what a vacation at sea is. He doesn't know what a cruise ship is like. So he's really content with the puddle because he doesn't know what the ocean is. And I think our desires are like that. We get content with lesser things because we don't catch the vision for what God has to offer and for who God is. So what is your rule of life? You know, I think we all need to honestly assess that. In the very first lesson of this class, I urged us all to do a time audit to fill in how we spend our time, because how we spend our time reveals the way that we're spending our lives. And as Annie Dillard, this author, writes, the way you spend your days is the way you spend your life. So we need to be thinking about this. And then we should evaluate how it's doing for us. You know, I think one of the most insightful things I've ever heard Albert Mohler say is when he's evangelizing somebody, he'll ask them this question, what are you living for? And then he'll follow it up by saying, how's that working out for you? And I reframe that to say, how are you spending your time and how's that working out for you? You know, what's your rule of life and what's it actually doing for you? You know, are you angry? Sad, not finding joy in Jesus, you know, isolated, all these sorts of things. How are you spending your days? What's your rule of life? And then how's that working out for you? There's this common saying in the business world, your system is perfectly designed to give you the results that you're getting. I remember talking our church through that. I mean, none of you were here at the time, back when we first got here as we were pursuing this revitalization. It's like, hey, the system that you're using is perfectly designed for the results you're getting. So if you want different results, you have to actually change something about the system of your life. That's really hard. It takes commitment, it takes sacrifice, but it would be good for all of us to reflect on our life in Christ, in the manner of life that we have, and ask whether or not it's working for us, whether or not it's producing what we hope it would produce, and what ultimately are we looking to produce through the way that we live. This one's not a rhetorical question. What are Christians aiming to produce in their lives? Yeah, Christ-likeness with the aim to glorify God, but love, fruit of the Spirit. How about, you know, like, that's what we want produced in our life. So if we're not seeing a pattern of increasing production of the fruit of the Spirit, which is a result of the Spirit working in our lives, maybe there's something about the manner of life that we have that really needs to change. For some of us, it might just be tweaks. For others, it might be overhauling the entire system. But the system that we're using in our life, our rules of life, are perfectly designed to give us the results that we're getting. This can be discouraging for some people, but I think it's actually the pathway to hope. You know, when we're getting discouraged that we're not seeing growth and transformation, we can get frustrated for being in the rut. And sometimes that's what it is. You know, we bear fruit in our season. So it's not always that we're going to see the same amount of fruitfulness. But if we're over time not seeing change, transformation, whatever, we need to probably change the system of our life, the rule of life. What was that?
Start pruning.
Start pruning. And we'll get into that, because as we work to develop a rule of life, you have to start by cutting things out, not just trying to add things on top of. And in fact, you know, I think that's the reason why most of us get discouraged in our Christian faith, is we try to just add Jesus onto what we already have going on instead of clearing out what's going on to make space for Jesus. And I think there are Christians who teach that, which is just burdensome at the end of the day, because it sounds like, hey, do everything you're doing and then add a ton more of this onto your life. And we're all like, when? Like, how can I do that? It's not possible. So as we talk about constructing a rule of life, it can sound intimidating or even restricting. I'll just pause to say, if you're reading along, you're going to find many typos here, because I did not proofread this document. But that's okay, you know, we'll figure it out together. In a world that emphasizes personal freedom, the idea of implementing a rule of life may sound like an unwanted constraint that limits our freedom. But for most people who are living freely, true freedom is actually elusive. People who think they're free by acting on their every desire typically are the most lonely, empty, and unfulfilled people that you could ever meet. It works for a little while. Like, there's always that glow of life at the start when you just throw off the shackles of responsibility, but then it really becomes burdensome. There was one semester in college where I had this friend who will remain nameless, but he just seemed like he was living the good life. He cut classes all the time, he slept in all the time, he just worked out, and that was about it. But he seemed like he was having a lot of fun. So I took one semester to try to be like this guy, Josiah, and it was terrible. Like, it was fun for a couple weeks, but I didn't sleep well. I didn't produce what I wanted to produce in my life. The freedom was actually debilitating. And our world tells us, be free, do whatever you want. But when we look around at our world, I think there's no surprise that we have high rates of depression and drug use and all the rest, because it's not working. Our individual freedom isn't working for us. So a rule of life is an invitation to a very different kind of freedom than that of the modern world. It's an invitation to embrace the constraints that, if you give yourself to them, will eventually set you free. We all need restraints, because without them, we eventually become the kind of people that we don't want to be. And think about it. If you eat dessert without restraint, you're eventually not going to like yourself, even though for a while you enjoyed that. And I think if we're, like, being maybe honest or just thoughtful about it, like, the 15th Oreo into the pack is not as good as the third Oreo. Like, if we stopped with three, that would be good. The restraint actually allows us to enjoy it. But in an unrestrained way, we come to hate ourselves. And that's not true just for Oreos. It's true with everything. You know, if you sleep all the time, eventually, you know, medically, too much sleep is actually bad for you. Like, it doesn't help you. Too much of freedom is actually not good. So, as I mentioned earlier, the way we spend our days is how we spend our lives. And if we spend it freely, we actually don't find true freedom. We find death. So Comer takes some everyday examples. He writes, picking up your phone first thing upon waking and checking social media isn't just a bad habit. It's a choice to let yourself become formed into a certain kind of person. The kind of person who is always anxious and whose first thought is going to whatever you're looking for on your phone. Who's before you step out of bed, dissatisfied with your life, so you're finding a source of life through scrolling on social media. Spending more time reading the news than reading scripture isn't just wrong. It's a choice to become more like your favorite news commentators than like Jesus. I mean, I think that's interesting. How often did Jesus comment on the political events of his day? Not that often. How often do Christians spend thinking about the political events of their day versus the teaching of Jesus? I'd say, sadly, way more often. Spending your money on yet another thing you don't need isn't just playing around with a disposable income. It's feeding an appetite within you that will grow only more ravenous. So the point is that when it comes to being a Christian, we aren't primarily asking, is this sinful or not? Like, we're not asking, is it sinful to watch this news clip? Or is it sinful to have Instagram? What we're asking is, what are these things doing to shape us, and what kind of person are we becoming as we engage with them? You know, for parents, I guess, you know, most of the parents in this room, your kids are gone, so you've either made all of your mistakes or all of your good choices already. But like, when we think about parenting kids, and when I think about trying to be a pastor, you know, a father of the church, we might say, like, I don't want to emphasize things so much as being sinful or not sinful, because so many of the choices we have before us don't fall neatly into that category. So many activities aren't sinful or not sinful. Like, those categories don't work. But what does work is asking questions like, what is this doing to me? Like, who is this turning me out to be? And when we start asking that question, it allows us to shape the pattern of our life while also acknowledging exceptions to the rule of life that we're going to take on. So I think when it comes to something like social media, like and you're trying to figure out, should my 14-year-old have whatever? I mean, 14-year-olds don't have Facebook. I mean, Gideon, what social media, and Andrew, what social media do kids your age have? Instagram. Okay, yeah, so when you're asking, should I let my kid have Instagram? I think you should be thinking about the shaping. And for you guys, as you're in high school, is you relate to social media. You don't really have to ask, is this sinful or not? You should be asking, what is this doing to me? And like, look into it from all the Christian principles, and look into it from the scientific realities where they can show what's happening to your teenage brain as it's being shaped, where it's almost like a drug that's prohibiting your brain from developing in the way that it should. You know, we want to look at who we're becoming, not isolated, legalistic, is this sin or not? And as soon as you can break free from that, you don't have to feel burdened or feel restricted by something, because you're not just avoiding something, you're pressing forward into a particular way of life. So I'll keep using athletics, because this is, you know, I think a great metaphor for the way for our Christian life. Paul uses it. When I was in high school, my friends and I would, especially once I got a car, you know, we could go out after church on Sunday and hang out somewhere. And we would often end up at Culver's. And because I was a wrestler, and I took on the identity of a wrestler, and I wanted to be healthy and be the best wrestler, I wanted to be shaped in a particular way, there were many times that I would be sitting eating a salad while everybody else were, you know, they were down in concrete mixers, you know, and they were becoming certain kinds of people, and I was becoming a certain kinds of person, and I didn't feel restricted or even weird, you know. No high schooler wants to feel weird. I didn't feel weird about it, because I had a vision of who I was going to become, and I had a plan to get there, and it included eating salads, which I don't particularly love, while all my friends were eating custard, you know, not ice cream, custard. I think if you can import that mentality to our Christian life, we stop worrying about being called a prude or a Puritan, and we start being concerned with the vision of life that we're pursuing. And at the end of the day, you know, I was talking with a guy just a week ago asking me, can Christians smoke marijuana? I'm like, well, Christians can technically do anything because that a human can do because we're humans. But should we? You know, what's that going to do to us? And what are you pursuing through that? And at the end of the day, I think adopting a life of having marijuana in my, like smoking a joint as part of my morning routine, as this guy does, doesn't shape me into the kind of person I want to be. So I don't need a Bible verse that says don't smoke marijuana. I need a vision of who I want to be and a plan to get there. My plan to be like Jesus doesn't include smoking a joint every morning. I don't think yours should either. You know, maybe someone can make an argument for that. I don't think so. Let's adopt that way of thinking. Who do we want to become, and what are we? How is what we're doing in our daily lives shaping us in that direction or keeping us from going there? So Comer uses the illustration of a gardener. Gardeners have two primary jobs: tend the plants and keep out the weeds. Comer doesn't reflect on the creation account in Genesis 2 where Adam was placed in the garden as a gardener, typologically as a priest-king, but I think we could reflect on that initial responsibility to work and guard the garden. Isn't that what Adam was told to do? To work and guard the garden. We need to have a way of life where we're thinking about working our lives, tending to what we want to grow in our life, and then guarding our lives, keeping outside forces that would harm our growth away from us. Each of us has the responsibility to work and guard the garden of our hearts, seeking to nurture the fruit of the Spirit that's growing within us, and to guard that fruit from being corrupted or destroyed by weeds or outside influences. So when it comes to creating a rule of life, we should be asking, what do I want to put into my life, and what do I want to keep out of my life? You know, that verse in Proverbs, I'm forgetting the reference. I don't know what it is. To guard your heart, or keep your heart with all diligence. You know, that's often quoted with respect to dating, like guard your emotional life or something like that. And maybe that's not like quite what the verse is getting at. I think it's getting at guard your heart, guard the things that you put into yourself, and guard the things that are growing, that you want to be growing in there. So ask yourself those questions. Like, what do I want to be putting into my life, and what do I need to keep out of my life? Those questions will shape what we do and what we don't do. These questions drive our rule of life. The rules that we put in place for ourselves then are not so much a legalistic force that we're attempting to utilize to create spiritual standing or maturity. Rather, they're a recognition of the need for structure as we participate in God's work in our lives. The fact is that whether we're conscious of it or not, there are constraints on our life. So integrating rules for life is not a restraint that's, you know, keeping us from being totally free. Nobody is totally free. Talk to Ben about the myth of human freedom. Like, we're all limited beyond our control. Just the fact that you were born with the body that you have means that you're limited beyond your control. I would like to be 6'5" and able to dunk a basketball. I can't. So my human freedom to dunk a basketball is constrained by my embodiment. We're constrained by the country that we live in and the culture that we have and so many other things. And then you add onto that the controlling features of algorithms of your smartphone and your devices and everything else. We are not as free as we like to think that we are. There are constraints on our life, so we need to pick the constraints to the best ability that we have of our ability. So Comer writes, coming up with rules can put your life back under the control of your deepest desires. Choose your own constraints, or they will be chosen for you, not by the Spirit of God stirring your own heart toward love, but by a programmer in Silicon Valley working to steal your time and shape your behavior. Yeah, that's just reality. Now, I think Comer needs to recognize and acknowledge more that there are constraints on our lives that we can't choose. I think he needs to acknowledge that a little bit more. But still, his point stands. There's much that we can choose, and there's much that's being chosen for us that we can set aside if we make better choices. Comer puts it starkly, the choice is yours, rule or be ruled. And that just reminds me of Genesis 4, when God tells Cain that sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, so you must rule over it. You know, that's a good lesson for our lives. So you might sense that living according to a rule of life will simply add things to your already busy days. But the role of the rule of life is to guard and to guide, and that means that you'll need to add elements to your life, but it also means that you'll need to have carefully and thoughtfully removed certain habits and practices from your life. So he writes, you're going to have to say no more often than yes, because there are only so many hours in a day and so many days in a life. Bless you. So there are only 168 hours in your week. So you're going to have to say no to a lot more than you're going to be able to say yes to. And the secret is saying no to the right things and yes to the right things. Let me quickly list four benefits of a rule of life. First, it helps you turn vision into reality. We all know the phrase that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We can have the best of intentions, but having good intentions isn't enough. Most of us genuinely desire what is good, but we fail to achieve it because we avoid, procrastinate, and make excuses rather than take necessary steps to move forward in our heart's desires. So we constantly self-sabotage. Without a plan, we won't achieve our desires. So I think, you know, some of us like plans and structure. It's part of our inclinations, our personality, whatever. So I was reflecting on, I think I was in third grade, and my family lived in North Dakota at the time, which is known for a lot of snow. You know, the snow was coming, and I wanted to be the kind of son who would get up early and have the sidewalk shoveled before anyone even woke up. And then I wanted to be able to enjoy a cup of hot chocolate by myself, you know, after shoveling. So I had those aspirations. And I knew I needed to put a plan into place that would force me to do it. So I took this dinosaur sticky note pack that I had gotten for my birthday and wrote a note to my parents saying, I will be getting up at 5 a.m. to shovel the driveway. And I stuck that note on the door so I knew my parents would see it when they went to lock the door before bed. So I was being held accountable. And then I had an alarm clock that was on my headboard. And I had this really cool headboard with a shelf on it, so my alarm clock was on there. And to make sure that I would get up, you know, I set my alarm clock for 4:45 because I wanted to be out shoveling by 5. And I went to our kitchen cabinet and I took out this old Cool Whip container and I filled it with water and set it next to my alarm clock so I would reach back and hit off, put my hand in the water, and then wipe my face. So I had a plan to achieve my desires. And I think that for most of us, we have to have that or it won't happen. Like, I know myself, and I am incredibly lazy. Like, apart from structure, I grew up in a home where the TV was just on all the time. And that's in my DNA, and it's in my nurture. And by default, I would just sit and watch TV all day. I need structure. And I need something that will help turn my vision into reality. So I want to become the kind of guy who meditates on the word of the Lord day and night. So I have to have a plan for memorizing scripture, or it just doesn't happen. I'm 33 and I haven't yet memorized key texts of scripture or dwelt on them. You know, so what I'm trying to say is we all need this structure. For some of us, we've realized that early on and maybe it's part of our personality to get the structure. But for all of us, apart from the structure, we won't achieve or pursue the kind of life that I think we all desire to be living. We self-sabotage all the time. This rule of life will move us from aspirational ideas to authentic transformation. A rule of life can take our good desires and turn them into reality by habituating them into our bodies, literally rewiring our central nervous systems. So Christians need to think a lot about how habits work, because a rule of life is just creating a habit of life that helps us follow Jesus. So when I was in college, I read this book by Charles Duhigg called The Power of Habit. And he talked about the way that our routines form us and they shape us in a particular way. And he gives a case study of this guy. I think he had dementia or Alzheimer's. And this guy got up He brushed his teeth, he walked outside, he took his whole walk around the block and came inside, and then he didn't even realize he had done it. But because he had done that every day for his adult life, when he now had Alzheimer's or dementia, he still kept doing the things he desired to do most because it was built into him. It was built all the way into the basal ganglia, this part of our brain that's like at the stem of our brain that kind of takes on our deepest patterns. You hear of people in nursing homes who like can't hold an intelligent conversation, but they're singing hymns and reciting scripture, like the things that are dearest to them. The things that we want deeply ingrained in us, we must structure into our lives. So I think it would be good for all of us to think about our habits and think about the power of habit. So read Duhigg, read Drew Dix, Your Future Self Will Thank You. Think about these things. I think Christians have not done this very well, at least in the world that I've been a part of. So even in college, when I read this book, The Power of Habit, I went up to the chair of the Bible department and asked him, okay, what do Christians think about habit formation and like brain formation? He's like, oh, I don't know, I've never thought about that. Well, I think we all need to think about this. We need to shape our lives, form habits that will transform us into certain kind of people. Now, some people will say that's not genuine and authentic, and Christians just need to be their authentic selves. That's silly. Don't tell Patrick Mahomes he's not being his authentic self when he gets out on the football field because he spent hours to practice and hours lifting. You know, like, don't tell people they're not their. What we've done through habit formation is become our authentic selves, who we really want to be. And really, that can only happen through transformation, because by default, we're broken and fractured. So number one, it will help us turn vision into reality. Number two, it will help you experience peace as you live in alignment with your deepest desires. So this guy, have you heard of Stephen Covey or Stephen Covey? I don't know how you pronounce his name. Covey. I think he's probably like a Mormon or something like that who takes, you know, virtuous principles and applies them into the business world. He wrote this book called The 7 Habits for Highly Effective People. I think this book is pretty helpful. You know, he has 4 quadrants of how we use our time. Urgent and not important. Urgent and important. Important but not urgent. You know, I forget all 4. I'd need to like write them out to get the full box. But he talks about how we need to categorize our life and things that are not urgent and not important. Like, we need to just filter those out of our lives. And the things that are urgent but not important, we need to come up with systems so that we're not ruled by the tyranny of the urgent, because there are so many important but non-urgent things that we neglect. But he says that we achieve inner peace when our schedule aligns with our values. I mean, I think that's probably true. When our schedules align with our values, we are able to live in a more peaceful way. Comer comments, because our schedules are so often not aligned with our values, many of us live with this electric current of anxiety pulsing through our nervous systems all the time. It's just there, nagging at us and draining our energy reserves. I think that's true. We fill our schedules with things that are not important and that don't align with our values and desires. T.S. Eliot, a long time ago, remarked that we're all constantly distracted from distraction by distraction. And if you've ever scrolled through Instagram while watching a TV show, you've been distracted by distraction. You know, that's just how we live our lives, by default. So we need to work to align our schedules and what fills our time with our deepest desires, with our values, ultimately with our desire to be with God. And Comer comments that particularly in our age, we live in a world where everything is designed to stoke our fear and feed our anger by any means necessary. So to live a life of peace in the digital age will demand a kind of resistance. And not just a resistance from non-Christians trying to demand our attention, but I'd say even Christians who are trying to demand our attention, or people with so-called Christian agendas trying to demand our time and attention. Remember, this isn't a choice between sinful and not sinful, but what's best to move us in the right direction, what's going to form us and shape us. So, you know, I'll just keep using examples from my life of things, you know, I've done negatively as well. I think there was a time in my life where there's this guy who, I guess I already referenced once today, this guy, Albert Mohler, has a podcast called The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. There was a time in my life where I listened to that every day, and I think it was pretty helpful. He was, I think, helpful in a lot of ways. But over time, over years, I started to realize how that podcast shaped me to be always anxious and unsettled and fearful and concerned about issues that I had no control over. And me waking up every day, you know, this was my routine for longer than I'd like to admit. I'd wake up, I'd get a cup of coffee, and I'd sit in bed, and I'd listen to the briefing, and then a normal news outlet podcast, and then a third shorter podcast, to where I was listening to three news podcasts to start every single day. What do you think that was shaping me to think about all the time? And I mean, it was forming me to be the kind of person I don't want to be. Now, is Albert Mohler being sinful by doing a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview? No, but do we need that? I don't think so. And in fact, you know, if Albert Mohler brought me into his confidence and he wanted my advice on what he's doing, I'd say, dude, maybe do this once a week. Because I think it's maybe shaping you to be the kind of person that you don't really want to be at the end of the day, is you're spending your whole life doing this. So think about it for yourself. You know, like, I think that there are certain pastors who have hobby horses, and we can listen to their sermons, and all we get are their hobby horses, and we're not really getting Jesus. But we feel like, because we're listening to a sermon, we're doing something good and godly. Well, you know, like, I could start listing names if you want me to, but I'd say that there are some pastors and sermons that we should just stop listening to, at least on the regular. They might be good every once in a while. There are some Christian books that are, or so-called Christian books, that will shape our hearts in a negative direction. I don't think that anyone in here is probably reading Amish romance novels on the daily, but like, I think that's a category of Christian literature that's actually probably harming people, not moving them in the right direction. So all I'm trying to say is that we need an act of resistance in our lives through this rule of life, and sometimes we need to resist overtly non-Christian things, and then at other times we need to resist even so-called Christian resources. That makes sense? Okay. If you want me to analyze what you're doing, let me know, because I'm happy to have an opinion on everything. But I think we all just need to take stock of our own life and then try to connect the dots between who we are and what we're doing. Like I had to do when I was realizing, man, I'm always on edge every single day. And when I, like, after months of not listening to the news every single morning and instead, you know, doing the Dwell Bible app where I'm listening through the Bible in like 90-day cycles, like I'm a different kind of person, closer to who I want to be than when I was listening to the news every day. Just a few minutes here. We need to cultivate a rule of life that will help us become the kind of person we want to be. I recommend that as we shape the pattern of our life, we do so in community, letting other people speak into the practices and patterns and habits in our lives. I think a valid critique of Comer's book is that he does tend towards an individualistic cultivation of a rule of life or a habit of life. And the fact is that most of our life is spent by ourselves or at work or with our families, so most of our spiritual practices will be somewhat individualistic or on a smaller community level. But I think it's important to have godly friends or a spiritual director or a pastor talk through the shape of your week with you. You know, I always think it's interesting to ask people, tell me about how you spend your normal day. Like, what does a normal day look like? And I think it would be good for us to get other people's eyes on our normal day, so maybe they can help us arrange what we're doing. You know, talk to people about who the top three people that you listen to every week are. Like, what are the top three podcasts that you listen to? Because maybe those aren't actually doing for you what they should. What are the top three TV shows that your family is watching right now? Maybe that's good, maybe it's not. You know, like, talk with people you trust about how you spend your money. Like, all of these sorts of things. Open your life to let other people speak into you the way you're being formed. Third, a good rule of life will help you live at the right pace. It won't cause you to be burned out, and it won't cause you to be lazy. Too much, too fast will accelerate to hurry, killing our spiritual lives and sapping our emotional energy, inevitably burning down our soul. But the reverse is also true. Too little, too slow, and we atrophy, falling into a lethargy, a self-centered fugue, what the ancients called acedia, or sloth. So we need to live at the right pace. Overachievers need a rule of life that's realistic, that slows them down. Underachievers need a rule of life that pushes them a little bit. A rule of life will help you balance freedom and discipline. What is a rule of life not? It's not a barometer for spiritual maturity. So your routine doesn't indicate necessarily spiritual maturity. In fact, like in my case, I need these routines to compensate for spiritual immaturity because of what I'll default to without them. But again, the aim is not just discipline for discipline's sake. It's discipline for discipleship's sake, for love's sake. So the metric of our spiritual health is love in the fruit of the Spirit, not what's on our daily routine or what time we get up in the morning. Comer explains, I know some people who never miss a week of church, read through the entire Bible every year, and never watch R-rated movies, all good things, but who are still self-righteous, controlling, fueled by anger, blind to their own shadow, and at times incredibly unloving. And I know others who are in a season of just trying to survive parenting little kids and barely getting 10 minutes a day to pray. But tired as they may be, they are becoming more loving with each passing year. Love is the metric to pay attention to. So even as we talk about forming a rule of life, the biggest thing that measures our spiritual health is not our rule of life, but who we're becoming. Two, a rule of life and these practices or spiritual disciplines are not a gloomy bore. They're actually joyful things like Sabbath and sleep and feasting and gratitude that we ought to incorporate into our spiritual lives. And this would be my critique of a lot of spiritual discipline literature, is they talk about things only as if it's like difficult. And that's true because spiritual disciplines are difficult, but paired with the discipline of fasting is the discipline of feasting. Not gluttony, but feasting. So there's actually really joyful things that we ought to incorporate into our lives. They're not a form of merit. Spiritual discipline and practices, a rule of life, takes effort, but none of this earns our favor with God. I think we should believe that God smiles at us every time we try to take a step toward him. I think we can make God happy in that regard because he's our Father. He loves us, and he loves it when his children walk in the way that they ought to walk. But we never earn our salvation or earn merit or favor or something like that. So a rule of life and spiritual disciplines should not be taken in that legalistic way. Fourth, they shouldn't be the Christian version of virtue signaling. You know, we don't posture towards these things just to get approval of other people. Jesus warned against that in Matthew 6 when he talks about prayer and fasting and generosity. Don't do it for the sake of other people, do it genuinely in pursuit of the Lord. And then fifth, they're not a means of control. So what is a rule of life? Basically, they're practices that allow us to participate in the work of God in our life. And I think that we all need to commit to growing in the spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices. The rule of life is a tool to help us obey Jesus and to facilitate our transformation. So we'll talk about what these practices are next week, but this week I'd just like you to think about the necessity of having a rule of life or a conscious, intentional plan for following Jesus. And if you want to read a book that might help you in this direction, I've listed a dozen or so of them at the end of this. I think some would be good for you to read maybe over the course of a year if you'd like to think about intentional pursuit of a habit or way of life in following Jesus. All right, we're at our time, even over by 2 minutes, but thank you for your attention.